Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
A new governor and almost completely new Florida cabinet hit the ground running in Tallahassee, and there are some surprises right off the bat.
And I don't know that there's any way you can look at this case and think that those ideals of justice were satisfied. Indeed, they were perverted.
Also this week, newly inaugurated Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to make a decision on whether or not to drop a lawsuit against smoking medical marijuana.
We'll have an announcement on that probably, you know, within a week or two.
We'll also find out how Floridians with past felony convictions have been responding to the constitutional amendment giving most of them the right to vote, and we'll explore the concept of restorative justice. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. As we start off this Capitol Report, a brand new Florida governor, mostly a new Florida cabinet, and at today's initial meeting of that new governor and cabinet dynamic, Sean Mulcahy joins us. And Sean, a lot of surprises out of this new governor and cabinet. Let's start off with what he mentioned during his inaugural speech, which was an emphasis on the environment, particularly restoring the state's water resources. What's going on with that?
Thursday, Governor Ron DeSantis announced this huge change in environmental policy, specifically water. He's calling for $2.5 billion over the next 4 years for Everglades restoration. He announced a blue-green algae task force. He's calling on the South Florida Water Management District to expedite the Everglades Reservoir.
All right, let's talk about what's going on with the Florida Supreme Court, because as of January 8th, there were three mandatory retirements, three traditionally liberal-leaning justices, and now it is up to Governor DeSantis to appoint three new ones, and looks like one has already gone through the process with him.
Yeah, on Wednesday, Governor Ron DeSantis announced his first of three picks. It is going to be Barbara Lagoa. She's the first Cuban-American woman to hold the post, and she echoed a theme that judicial activism and legislating from the bench, she really says she is not going to do any of that. She's going to, you know, stick strictly to the law.
I am particularly mindful of the fact that under our constitutional system, it is for the legislature and not the courts to make the law.
It did not take long for Governor Ron DeSantis to hit the road as far as checking out one of the most severely impacted areas in the state in the wake of last October's Hurricane Michael. So he headed west from Tallahassee first thing this week, Sean.
He said that he is committed to helping Mexico Beach recover, and he said that it's not going to be forgotten.
As long as we are in West Florida, the superintendent of public schools in Okaloosa County, what happened there?
Basically, he is removing Okaloosa County School Superintendent Mary Beth Jackson. She's going to be replaced by the Assistant Superintendent Marcus Chambers. This comes after a grand jury report that was quite scathing in the way she handled things.
All right, now that gets us into the meat and potatoes, if you will, of the initial cabinet meeting. Everyone is new with the exception of Jimmy Patronis, the state CFO. He was appointed by Governor Rick Scott back in summer of 2017, so he's a holdover, but everybody else is brand new. A lot of folks, particularly in the Capitol Press Corps, had been kind of interested in how that dynamic would play out as far as this new group. So what did you see this morning?
So what was really striking was Nikki Fried, who is our agriculture commissioner. She is the only Democrat and the first time that the cabinet has had to work with a Democrat in a long time. And what it really seems like is she is going to be at least trying to make her position heard and doing her best to make sure that her side is heard out, because during the cabinet meeting, they were considering Governor Ron DeSantis's appointment for the Department of Veterans Affairs, State Representative Danny Burgess. She basically said that she doesn't think the process is fair, and she is holding out until a more fair and transparent process is completed.
Well, that brings us then, Sean, to a big surprise going into this morning's cabinet meeting. We had been talking about the Groveland for a situation dating back to, oh my gosh, almost 70 years ago in Lake City, Florida, involving four African Americans who had been convicted of a crime which the FBI evidence had essentially negated. And the governor and cabinet were originally supposed to what? Just consider, just look at this case this morning? They did a lot more than that.
Right before the meeting, there were reports coming out, and apparently some of the family members of the Groveland Four had been told that they weren't going to be deciding anything. It was just going to be a discussion on whether or not to pardon them. And then at the end today, after some quite emotional testimony from both sides, Governor Ron DeSantis called a vote, and they unanimously pardoned all four members of the Groveland Four.
You'd like to think that in America, no matter what passions or prejudices may be on the outside of a courtroom, then when you actually get into that courtroom, that it's the law applied to the facts without passion or prejudice that will decide your fate. And I don't know that there's any way you can look at this case and think that those ideals of justice were satisfied. Indeed, they were perverted time and time again.
A lot of drama in this first week of a brand new administration here in Tallahassee. Sean Mulcahy, you've been right on top of it. We'll look forward to your ongoing reports as we go forward with Capitol Report from week to week. Thanks so much. Although Florida voters approved medical marijuana a few years ago, a legal battle has raged ever since on whether the medicine can be smoked. As Blaise Gainey reports, a new governor and mostly new cabinet may be significantly changing the dynamic of those arguments.
I think at the end of the day, when the people speak on these things, you know, we want to implement their will. I don't think that that's been done fully.
That was Ron DeSantis weighing in after a Tallahassee circuit judge agreed with a lawsuit filed by Orlando lawyer John Morgan. The lawsuit claims a 2017 law is unconstitutional because it doesn't allow medical marijuana to be smoked. The state's stance is that the constitutional amendment approved by voters in 2016 does not explicitly allow smoking, and there are other methods of consumption. Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried supports allowing smokable marijuana and wants the governor to drop the state's appeal.
I think that, you know, so many of our patients are needing medical marijuana in all of its form, and that's in its purest of forms. And so there is, who are we to be in the way of patients and doctor access? And so if a patient is getting recommended to have the raw flower, then that's what they should be getting.
When asked when he may make a decision about the state's appeal, DeSantis says it'll be soon.
We'll have an announcement on that probably, you know, within a week or two.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Blaise Gainey.
Still to come on Capitol Report, the federal government shutdown is having a serious impact in the Sunshine State.
No one really wants to go to work and know that they're not going to be paid. So that's definitely put us in a stressful position.
Hospice doctors want lawmakers to loosen restrictions involving pain medications for dying patients.
They were not out there looking for opioids in the streets. They were mainly bedbound and in pain, short of breath, being managed by hospice providers.
And the idea of restorative justice has begun catching on in Florida. Amidst the U.S. government shutdown, now going on 20 days, federal employees and their agencies in Florida are feeling it in different ways. As Ryan Daly reports, the question of when the shutdown will end is dominating the minds of many.
Not knowing when your next paycheck is going to come. No one really wants to go to work and know that they're not going to be paid. So that's definitely put us in a stressful position.
Kristen Morgan works in the Bureau of Prisons and is vice president of the local American Federation of Government Employees Union. She says as she and many of her coworkers were leaving for holiday vacations, the robocall came in.
There was a mass call that let everybody know that there was a lapse in appropriations. And leave has been canceled, your vacation has been canceled, you need to return to work or face disciplinary action.
Ray Coleman is president of the Federal Workers Union and another of about 250 employees at the federal prison in Tallahassee.
This will be our first complete paycheck that we will not receive. So we've been having to come to work day in and day out and do our jobs, and we've been kind of hoping things will get better, but the reality's kind of set in that, you know, we're not going to get a paycheck. And working at a federal prison, it's already a stressful environment.
Coleman and members of the union he heads held a rally Thursday aimed at getting the attention of Florida's leaders in Washington. Meanwhile, the Federal Emergency Management Agency will not be hindered by the U.S. government shutdown. That's the word from spokesperson Deanna Frazier in the agency's Tallahassee office.
You know, FEMA programs and services that are currently operating, including the emergency work and public infrastructure and mitigation projects, won't be impacted by the shutdown, and they continue. And there's no disaster projects that are on hold presently.
Frazier says the funding stream for FEMA comes from the National Disaster Relief Fund. That's in contrast to other agencies under the Department of Homeland Security, which operate on funds from the federal budget. As President Donald Trump continues the shutdown as a holdout for funding a U.S.-Mexico border wall, questions abound about Trump declaring a state of emergency. The New York Times and other outlets this week reported the president is weighing the possibility of diverting disaster funds from the Army Corps of Engineers to build the wall, some of which is earmarked for Florida. Newly minted Governor Ron DeSantis weighed in on that during his first days on the job.
My sense is, just as somebody who studied the Constitution, president wouldn't be able to just appropriate his own money under any circumstances. You may be able to repurpose some money. I'm not sure how that works. Obviously, anything that was done on the disaster front, we have people that are counting on that.
Florida's federal courts are feeling the squeeze as well. Pamela Marsh is a former U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Florida. Marsh supervised about 78 employees from Pensacola to Gainesville, including attorneys and support staff.
In my opinion, the most difficult thing about these budget shutdowns is having to tell your workforce who is an essential employee and who is a non-essential employee.
In the case of the U.S. Attorney's Office, essential employees are criminal prosecutors doing law enforcement work.
But then you had to tell a good portion of your office that they were non-essential, and that doesn't really feel so good. And those are the folks who are doing the civil cases, the civil litigation, where the United States has been sued or the United States is suing someone else.
Marsh says non-essential employees were furloughed, unable to do work on their cases. She adds the attorneys would file motions requesting a stay of the civil litigation, and most would be granted.
So for as long as the stay is in place and the civil litigation lawyers can't work, there's going to be a delay in those cases. So gumming up the system, yes, but everything is staying. So all of it, it's just like it comes back to life once the shutdown's lifted.
But as Marsh points out, federal employees who have missed paychecks have the chance to receive back pay if Congress approves.
Historically, when the shutdown ends, Congress has voted to give back pay to both the essential government workers who worked and the non-essential government workers who stayed home from work.
For federal prison employee Ray Coleman and many others, though their paychecks have been compromised, the expenses haven't stopped.
Yeah, people have day-to-day bills that they have to pay, healthcare expenses, child care expenses. I've been telling, you know, a lot of media outlets that we have people that are still recovering from a hurricane. So the morale is down. However, it brings us together as one unit because we're all in the same situation.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
A law that went into effect last July requires medical providers to check a statewide database before prescribing opioids for patients. Now lawmakers are being asked to consider an exemption for doctors who care for terminally ill patients. Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan reports a Senate panel got an overview of the law this week and its impact so far.
The Senate Health Policy Committee got an update on the implementation of the law known as House Bill 21. The law targets controlled substances that are labeled as Schedule 2 or higher. That includes painkillers like OxyContin and codeine. Schedule 2 drugs are classified as having a high potential for abuse. Claudia Kemp is executive director of the Florida Board of Medicine.
The new law limits a prescription for a Schedule 2 opioid to treat acute pain to a 3-day supply. There is an exception A practitioner may prescribe up to a 7-day supply if the physician, if the practitioner determines more than a 3-day prescription is necessary. But if they do go up to the 7-day supply, they have to indicate acute pain exception on the prescription and document the justification for deviating from the 3-day limit.
Each time a controlled substance listed as Schedule 2 or higher is dispensed, it must be reported to the state's Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, also known as the database. And in most cases, when a controlled substance is prescribed or dispensed, practitioners must check the database to review a patient's history. The goal is to prevent doctor shopping when drug abusers seek multiple doctors to write them prescriptions. Database Program Manager Rebecca Poston says database registrations have increased by more than 40% since July, and prescriptions have declined.
We've seen so far in the data 3.8% reduction in the number of patients receiving controlled substances in the state of Florida. We've also had an 8.6% reduction in prescriptions for hydrocodone sustained actions that have been dispensed.
Now the committee is considering whether the law should be tweaked for doctors treating people who are dying. The law exempts hospice and palliative care patients from the required prescription limit, but their providers still have to check the database in order to prescribe the controlled substances that are often needed at the end of life.
These are not patients that are at risk of going out there and doing the things that we don't want them to do.
Dr. Stephen Leedy is a board member of the Florida Hospice and Palliative Care Association. He says Florida had about 137 hospice patients last year. That makes up 10% of the hospice patients nationwide. He says their average stay was 3 weeks before they died.
That 3 weeks is an important number. During those 3 weeks, these patients were not out there doctor shopping. They were not out there looking for opioids in the streets. They were mainly bedbound and in pain, short of breath, being managed by hospice providers.
Leedy says checking the database each time controlled substances are ordered leads to delays in medicating a dying patient.
It's not unusual for a patient to require 6 to 7 dosage adjustments of their opioid pain medications within the first 72 hours of hospice care. Each of those dosage adjustments requires a query of the database to make sure that the patient has not doctor shopped in the 2 hours since the previous administration of the dose of opioid. You can imagine, if you do the math and think about it, how ridiculous this process becomes after a while in terms of the number of queries that need to be done.
Leedy says the association's members recognize opioid abuse as a significant issue in Florida, but he says hospice providers and patients aren't contributing to the state's opioid problem.
There's a pharmacy provider in the state of Florida, One Point Patient Care, who provides only medications to hospice patients. And they indeed met the requirement of House Bill 21 by performing the queries, performed 68,000 queries on hospice patients and discovered 0 opportunities for identifying diversions. So 0 doctor shopping, 0 return on investment of that particular initiative.
The Florida Hospice and Palliative Care Association wants the legislature to exempt physicians from having to query the database or require them to check it only once when a dying patient is admitted for care. In order to make that change, a new bill will have to be filed, and supporters haven't found a lawmaker yet who's willing to sponsor the legislation. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Gina Jordan.
On the same day that Governor Ron DeSantis and the state's 3 cabinet members were sworn into office, more than 1 million Floridians became eligible to vote for the first time since their felony convictions. John Davis from member station WGCU in Fort Myers says that's the consequence of Amendment 4, which passed overwhelmingly in the November election.
Amendment 4 automatically restores the voting rights of felons, or returning citizens as they prefer to be called, who have completed all terms of their sentence and who were not convicted of murder or of a felony sex offense. The amendment overturns an 1868 Florida law that banned residents with felony convictions from automatically having their voting rights restored once their sentences are complete. Fort Myers resident Neil Voles is political director of the bipartisan Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, which worked to get the amendment on the ballot. 13 years ago, Voles pleaded guilty to felony conspiracy related to the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal. He says that's ultimately when the story of his involvement in the Amendment 4 movement began.
I made some stupid decisions and crossed some lines I shouldn't have crossed, and ultimately had to live with the consequences of those decisions, which involved losing my job and losing a house and getting divorced and starting life over.
Bowles is now one of the many former felons who can now register to vote in Florida.
This morning, I went down to the Supervisor of Elections office and registered to vote and was there with family, with friends, with fellow returning citizens, those of us who with past felony convictions, and we celebrated. Man, it was a really overwhelmingly emotional experience and one that I'll never forget.
Bowles says he spoke with Lee County Election Supervisor Tommy Doyle before going to register to make sure the process would go smoothly. Collier County Supervisor of Elections Jennifer Edwards says it was business as usual at her office as well.
We accept the voter registration application form, or the registrant can actually register online in Florida now. And that information goes to the Florida Division of Elections. And then they do the research and they notify us on the action to take. We just send the new voter a voter registration information card. We do not ask questions when someone comes in to register to vote. So only if the registrant made a comment would we even know that they may have been a felon.
Whether these new registrations will stay on the voter rolls, however, could still be up in the air. Newly sworn in Governor Ron DeSantis says the restoration of voting rights should wait until state lawmakers approve some implementation language. The legislature doesn't convene until March, but in some Florida counties, municipal elections are scheduled for next month, and state election officials have so far offered no guidance. Edwards says the amendment came up at the Florida State Association of Supervisors of Elections Midwinter Conference in Sarasota last month, which was also attended by Florida's Secretary of State and the Director of the State Division of Elections.
And they told us that at that time, they were unsure what the process would be and whether or not there would be any legislation passed to assist in implementing.
Amendment 4 was endorsed by every Democratic candidate running for statewide office in the last election and was largely opposed by Republicans like U.S. Senator Rick Scott, who dramatically restricted Florida's executive clemency process during his time in the governor's office. But returning citizen and newly registered voter Neil Vols says it's a mistake to assume that felons will act as a homogenous voting bloc.
For years, those of us with felony convictions, we weren't allowed to be Republicans or Democrats. So the truth is this idea of people projecting onto us what we should or should not do is something that we don't necessarily view as a positive thing. Our view is that we've worked too hard and too long to just simply give our vote away to some partisan interest, when the truth is partisan politics blocked the progress that ultimately the citizens themselves had to step up to fix.
Even with the possibility of illegal battle ahead, Vols says the implementation of Amendment 4 is an inspiration to those in other states fighting for similar changes.
We are hearing from folks in Iowa and Virginia and Kentucky, the states that still haven't made the changes that we just made in November. And it's a real honor to be an encouragement of other folks who want to try and make the kind of changes that we just made as a state. So yeah, it's reverberating all over the country.
I'm John Davis in Fort Myers.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, for many years, Florida lawmakers relentlessly ramped up the state's criminal penalties and took a decidedly lock-'em-up-and-throw-away-the-key approach to criminal justice. But significant change is underway, partly driven by a concept called restorative justice. Connor McBride is serving 20 years at Wakulla Correctional Institution for killing his fiancée, Anne Gromaire, when they were both 19 years old. It could have been a life sentence, but her parents asked the state attorney for less time. And as Margie Menzel reports, their embrace of restorative justice is spreading.
If you're in a relationship that seems out of control, if you feel like you're out of control, if you don't understand why you're doing it, why you're hurting the person you love, or why the person you love is hurting you, seek help. Please seek help.
McBride cut this PSA for the Florida Restorative Justice Association. It's part of his agreement with Kate and Andy Gromaire, whom he knew well after dating their daughter for 3 years. He shot her during a fight in 2010.
We knew that Connor could never repay us for what had happened. We were never going to get our daughter back. And the only thing we could do was to let go of that. And after we forgave him, we wanted to have a say in the process of the criminal justice proceedings against him.
Restorative justice is typically used for lesser crimes, such as vandalism or theft. It involves paying restitution, taking responsibility, and never committing that harm again, all under the auspices of the courts. The case of Ann and Connor is one of the first known modern uses of the practice following a homicide.
We had the opportunity to add provisions to his probation, such as taking anger management classes, speaking about teen dating violence, and working in the community in areas that Ann would have worked. I told Connor he had to do the good works of two people, and he's taken that to heart.
People often tell the Gromaires, "I could never do what you've done." But they and other practitioners of restorative justice say it prevents crime.
In some of our early correspondence, he asked me, what can I do? Well, you can't fix it. What you can do is you can make a difference where you are.
Agnes Fury is known as St. Agnes for her work with Leonard Scovins, who murdered her daughter Pat and grandson Chris in 1998. It took 7 years for her to contact Scovins, who is serving two life sentences.
It may not be the community he'd choose to live in, but it is part of our community, our wider community. And he can make a difference that might make a difference for somebody coming out. You know, most of his peers will come back and live with all of us. And if he can reach even one of those people, that can make a difference for somebody else's neighborhood.
According to the Florida Restorative Justice Association, nearly 75% of people convicted of violent crimes will be arrested again. And Dan Kahn, its executive director, points to the success of Leon County's Community Connections program at reducing recidivism among teens with an intensive 12-week program.
Our recidivism rate is right around 12%, which compares to similarly situated youth or closer to 27% countywide. And another statistic which I love is that close to a third of the teens that graduate from our program come back to us as volunteers and on their own time with no compulsion participate in another 3 or 4 month cycle with us to give back, to continue giving forward to other teens that are participating.
In schools, Kahn says, restorative justice practices can run from daily classroom activities through moderate level conflicts to a full-blown crisis.
And if you've got a practice in a school that really helps every student to feel included, that their voices matter, there's an ethic of respect and consideration, that's going to breed a culture in which there's real less likelihood of any kind of a violent act erupting. So restorative practices can be highly preventative and proactive.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Margie Menzel.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. We also thank Margie Menzel and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us again next week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.